Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado and I'll be your host for this episode. And today I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Andrew Snyder about Critical Bass, Street Carnival and Musical Activism in Olympic Rio de Janeiro, published by Wesleyan University Press in 2022. Critical Bass tells the story of neo-fanfarrismo, an explosive carnival brass band community turned activist musical movement in Rio de Janeiro as Brazil shifted from a country on the rise in the 2000s to one beset by various crises in the 2010s. Though predominantly middle class, neo-fanfarristas have creatively adapted the critical theories of carnival to militate for a more democratic city, illuminating the tangible obstacles to musical movement building. Andrew Snyder argues that festive activism with privileged origins can promote real alternatives to the neoliberal city, but meets many limits and contradictions in a society marked by diverse inequalities. Dr. Andrew Snyder is a U.S. American living in Portugal as a research fellow in the Institute of Ethnomusicology at the Universidade Nova de Lisboa. Since finishing his PhD at UC Berkeley in 2018 in ethnomusicology, he has increasingly worked as an editor, having co-edited the books Honk, A Street Band Renaissance of Music and Activism in 2020, and At the Crossroads, Music and Social Justice in 2022. He's also a trumpet player, and he has played with many of the groups he studies that we're going to talk about here today. Andrew, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So in the book's acknowledgments, you say that the quote, "The prospect that a growing internationally connected brass band movement that seeks to claim public space, spread inclusive musical education, and militate for a different world even existed in Rio de Janeiro was far from your mind when you started graduate school in 2010. So I want to know what happened. And this brings me to the question that I always like to start these interviews with. I want to know how your book came about, or what is your book's origin story?
So you mentioned that I'm a trumpet player, but at the time in 2010, I think I was trying to mention my naivety in relationship to this project. I wasn't even playing trumpet. I was playing guitar. I had majored in music and I played piano, but I had left trumpet in high school, where I had played a lot in bands and high school band, jazz bands, but I had really kind of stopped playing. The thing that brought me back was the explosion of the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011, which is now starting to be a bit of history because this was 12 years ago. But what Occupy Wall Street emerged in relationship as a reaction to the austerity crisis of the 2008 banking crisis. And as you know, many people went out to camp in Zuccotti Square in New York. And this method of occupying space went all over the US and all over the world. And there were various protests. So I started going to these protests when I was in the Bay Area in California, where I was going to graduate school. in ethnomusicology, looking for a project, not really sure what I was going to do. And I was going to these protests, and I kept on seeing this brass band in the streets, mobilizing protesters, giving them chants, feeding them lines to fit the occasion of protesting. And I found this really emotionally impactful, the fact that this group of people with brass instruments was able to mobilize so many people. And I was thinking, well, I don't know if I could really join these people because this looks like a really cool great group. And I haven't played trumpet forever. And even though I'm studying music, I'm not sure if they would accept me. But I went up and talked to them and they're like, you play trumpet? Great. So I got out my trumpet. I started playing with them. And I soon found myself playing in protests all over the Bay Area and became part of the group. And I started to shift my thinking in terms of what is the impact of music in public space? How can music become a tangible impact on people's bodies? Now, none of this has to do with Brazil, right? But I ended up going to a festival called Honk in Boston, which became a meetup point. And this is a festival network that will come back for me in very surprising ways. So I went to this Honk festival of activist street bands in Boston. And that first year, nothing to do with Brazil, but then I was in that network. And I heard about this band, Os Cidreis, in 2013, that had been asked to come to Boston for that Honk edition. So I followed that. I was interested in Brazilian music as a jazz musician, but my contacts with Brazil were very weak at the time. But I was, again, looking for a project, and I thought that this would be an interesting way to connect things. And in 2013, I went to Rio de Janeiro. I met with this group, and it happened to be 2013, which I will come back to. June 2013 was a massive moment of protests. And I found that many of the same kinds of ways of thinking about music as manifesting and mobilizing people in public space for various causes were happening there, but with many different important differences, namely way more people in the streets, way more festivity, way more intensity, and crucially connected to the carnival tradition.
Yes. So just have to let folks know that the connection here is that I'm a Brazilian studying U.S. carnival, and you are a U.S. American studying Brazilian carnival, and I think that's awesome. And I'm learning so much about Brazilian carnival with you. It's been amazing.
And you, from reading your book also.
But maybe some of the folks that are listening to us don't really know much about Brazil, Brazilian carnival. So let's start with some basic definitions here. What are blocos de rua or street carnival? I think a lot of people, when they think about Rio de Janeiro's carnival specifically, they think about Escola de Samba, that grandiose spectacle, and Carnaval de Rua is quite different. So explain a little bit about what that means. Yeah,
sure. I agree. I think that for someone outside of Brazilian cultural context, if you talk about Brazilian carnival, maybe you'll have an image of passistas or colorful dancers, maybe massive drum ensembles, and they might be thinking of the spectacle that is the Samba School parade. And this is an amazing tradition that brings thousands of people in each school to compete. But what is perhaps not of the streets, and why people don't talk about it, are not referring to that when they're talking about street carnival, is that it happens in with this structure called the Sambódromo, which is expensive. It's a spectator space. It has become increasingly commercialized. So street carnival is a term that refers to everything that is outside of that. Now, Samba schools, of course, also come from the streets, and we can think of all of these cultural manifestations as originally a part of a street carnival. But because of that division that has happened in the past several decades, street carnival has really been kind of thinking of itself in some ways as an alternative, sometimes even oppositional to this kind of commodified and spectacle carnival. So the term bloco, which you mentioned, the groups that we'll be talking about call themselves blocos. I define them usually as mobile participatory musical ensembles. Now, they're not always mobile. Sometimes they're stationary. They're participatory in the sense that there are many ways of interacting with them and being an audience member, dressing up in a costume or fantasia, they might be more or less participatory in the sense of who can play. Some groups you can just show up and play. Some groups are very structured. A bloco could be a group of friends with a pandero walking down the street. A bloco could also be bola preta, which has 2 million people in the streets. So it's a really expansive term. It's a really generic term. But the thing to keep in mind is that this sort of free, relatively spontaneous, relatively informal manifestation of people in public space is very distinct from the very formalized, very disciplined samba school model. And this is today we're talking about a huge number of people, a huge number of groups, by some estimations, 500 or so official blocos in Rio. And then there are the unofficial ones that don't subscribe or inscribe themselves in the rules. So we're talking about massive musical manifestations that are relatively uncontrolled compared to the samba schools.
Well, the other, I think, concept we need to explain so that folks can understand a little bit more what we're going to talk about next is neo-fanfarrismo. What is neo-fanfarrismo and how does it relate to Rio's carnival?
Neo-fanfarrismo is a term that, as I understand it, was coined by one of my main interlocutors, but it's a term that kind of has filtered through the air in the past, say, 15 years in Rio. And so if you just listen to the word neo-fanfarrismo, so the fanfare or fanfare, that refers to brass bands. So what I was looking at specifically were the brass bands. I talked about 500 blocos. I'm only talking about a little small section of this world, this brass and percussion tradition. So there is a brass and percussion tradition in Rio. There are many in Brazil, and there are many that are associated with carnival. The most iconic and technically impressive is probably from Recife, definitely from Recife, Frevo. But there's a tradition, there are various traditions in Rio as well. So the fanfarra, brass bands, neo, meaning some kind of new innovation on the brass band tradition, which we can talk about. And ismo, I think that this is where I'm getting this idea that neo-fanfarrismo is a kind of social movement. Is they use a kind of ism, neo-fanfarrismo or neo-fanfarism, which I think has a kind of implication of a not just being a scene, but a kind of having a political ideology. So this is something that comes out of the brass band tradition that is in carnival and innovates both in an aesthetic and a ethical way.
The first two chapters examine transformations and the emergence of neo-fanfarrismo movement from the brass blocos of the street carnival revival and the band's changing repertoires. I want you to talk a little bit about that. And you've started to explain this, but what is this tradition they're trying to revive? Or as some folks say, they're rescue, and I'm using rescue with air quotes, but what changed in their priorities over time as well?
Yeah, rescue is a translation of the word resgatar, right? And it's a term that people would use. So thinking about rescuing, recycling, renewing, reviving. So I mentioned the newness of neo-fanfarrismo, but that's a little bit in opposition to the initial urge of this brass movement in the 1990s and 2000s to revive certain repertoires and certain ways of playing and thinking about carnival. Now, so we haven't talked yet about this notion of revival, which is really important. So I said samba schools we can think of as originally having come out of a street carnival tradition. But the way that this was always explained to me was that if you're, say, a young person growing up in the 1990s, say, especially a middle-class person kind of outside of the samba school movement, the way that people talked about this was that there was relatively little carnival. The carnival was a time to travel. It was a time to leave Rio. It was not a time to stay and participate and create something. So there was this sense of carnival being dead. And if you go back a little further, the way that this was explained to me was that this very much had to do with Brazil's military dictatorship, which, as you know, began in 1964 and went until 1985. And the military dictatorship was highly repressive. And this again, the way this was explained to me, because I was not there, was not even alive, let alone in Brazil, but that the large groups of people organizing and being in public space were seen with skepticism, that things had to be much more ordered, that there was censorship. There were all of these elements that were a bit counter to the carnival spirit, or what people talked about as a kind of carnival spirit. And carnival groups play a role in being part of redemocratization protests in the early 1980s, and then they come out, and there's a certain politicization in them as they start to grow again in the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s. Ever since in the past three decades, I mean, we're really talking about a progressive and exponential growth in this sort of street carnival, which again, there was this view of the samba schools having been kind of co-opted, taken, commercialized, even a product of sort of ideological product of military governors, the military government. And so the street carnival kind of represents this alternative and potentially oppositional movement, one that was clamped down upon, and many people talk about having died during the dictatorship and having rebirth. So what are they renewing? What are they reviving? So in the case of the brass ensembles, they talked about the sort of the importance of the machinha genre, especially, which machinhas have always been in the air, but I think this is a military march descendant, ironic, ludic, fun genre of songs that are played by brass ensembles and people sing at the same time. So there was this, and it predates the samba schools as well. And we have, going back to late 19th century, Abriales by Chico Gonzaga. So a really old manifestation of Rio's musical culture done by brass bands. And so people revive this tradition. They also, some of the more technical groups revive choro as played by brass bands. Choro is an instrumental genre that kind of comes up at the same time that jazz comes up in the United States. You also have a sort of beginning to want to not just revive but play other genres. So I mentioned Frevo from Recife, which is a city in the Northeast. Some of these genres, these groups starting to play that. So it really starts off with this kind of nationalist and very city-based preoccupation, but nationalist in the sense of wanting to revive traditions that are authentically Brazilian, right? And I think that sort of is a critical nationalism, because it's not the dictatorship's version of nationalism. It's wanting to revive this repressed tradition of going out into the streets with your friends, with a group, with some instruments, and playing a bunch of songs that are older, but renewing and recontextualizing them in this new context of the turn of the millennium Rio.
So as a Brazilian, it's been amazing, like to me, really interesting reading your book and seeing how you make sense of some things that I took for granted and I didn't quite had a name I could explain this. One thing I was really interested in here is when you talk about, quote, the alternative as an identity rooted in race and class. So I wanted you to explain how you're using the term alternative whiteness and what do you mean by the strategy of disinheritance? Again, I was really interested in your discussion of the race and class dynamics between neofanfarrismo and escolas de samba. And as somebody who whose racial identity seems to shift when I moved from Brazil to the global north, I really appreciated your discussion of this alternative whiteness in Brazil.
Well, thanks. This is a really hard, territory, and territory that I often felt uncomfortable discussing, but felt that it was also uncomfortable because I also didn't feel like I knew how I had the terms to do it, and uncomfortable because I'm a white American, in a different cultural space. So starting with the idea of alternative, I kind of mentioned this before, but I think there's various ways that we can see this as part of an alternative culture. in the sense of being, you know, independent and wanting to be less mainstream and wanting to be DIY. These groups are very much self-produced. They're produced with very little money. There are groups of people putting on costumes, you know, taking a stake and putting up a banner and creating a standachi or a standard and bringing some musicians out into the streets and can bring lots of people together. This is the kind of what people understood to be an alternative spirit. When I asked people further, okay, so who are these people? People would also often say that it was the alternative middle class, and especially the alternative middle class of Zona Sul, or the South Zone of Rio, right? So there's a very kind of specific group of people. Zona Sul, the South Zone, is a middle class neighborhood that is not the favelas, though they're all favela. There are favelas in the area, but when you talk about South Zone, you're talking about the middle class, and you're talking about, yeah, when you're talking about alternative, you're not talking about the right wing. You're not talking about conservatives, who we'll discuss, right? Very ascendant in the 2010s. So alternative middle class. But of course, class and race are connected, especially in a society that was colonized by Europeans and experienced slavery and the legacies of slavery. So the middle class is whiter than the popular classes, right? So I tried to develop a vocabulary around this, despite the fact that people didn't really often talk about it in this way. They were much more likely to talk about it in terms of class differences. And this, I think, relates to not just Brazil, but in much of Latin America, you have these mythologies that are based on a kind of mixing, a valorization of the mixing of the cultures, and in that valorization, a kind of forgetting, intentional forgetting, right, or erasure of the very real inequalities. So the idea of using whiteness was to refer to those inequalities and really position this group of people as a relatively privileged group of people. So they're as we'll talk about, they're thinking of themselves as practicing a kind of musical activism, but they're very much doing so from a relatively positioned situatedness within Rio. And so I talk about whiteness as sort of an idea and a category, but of course not all the people who participate in this group, in these kinds of groups, are white, or would think of themselves as white, or would be read as white. So I try to use the term also whiter and blacker, and these are very imperfect terms, but to really kind of point out the fact that this is a spectrum, this is a racial spectrum, right? These are not fixed absolute racial identities. So that was the idea of alternative whiteness, and really trying to position these groups of people in their cultural, racial, class space. Disinheritance, this is another term that I kind of struggled with, but ultimately decided to use because, well, we talked about the movement of these groups, and especially these brass band groups and the street carnival in general, initially to try to revive cultural traditions and musical genres they felt had been either forgotten or erased. And so the idea of disinheritance doesn't really fit there, because I would say that's a kind of re-inheritance, right? It's kind of a retaking of what is thought of as one's own, a kind of nationalist movement. But in the mid-2000s, and this is really where this brass band revival movement becomes neo-fanfarismo and the newness of it, is there's a real, there's a shift in aesthetics and desire in terms of what to play. And this idea that I would always hear is, vamos tocar qualquer coisa, we're going to play whatever. We're going to play anything that we want. So really moving beyond this idea that carnival is necessarily national, is necessarily city-based, is necessarily even traditional, but the carnival is a space for innovation, playing international repertoires, playing with instrumental formats, playing with all kinds of expressive repertoires. And so neo-fanfarismo becomes a brass tradition or a brass movement that is playing all kinds of different repertoires. So you have other brass traditions from around the world, Balkan brass, New Orleans, as well as pop music, in Brazilian as well as international, You have global pop music. Afrobeat becomes really, from Nigeria, becomes a really popular thing to play. So you have what I would say is a disinheriting of the sort of carnival tradition in that. And I really also was using that term disinheriting in relationship to kind of a heritage studies way of thinking about this. If the heritage of carnival that's passed on is samba, and if that heritage is kind of understood as blacker, as an Afro-Brazilian tradition, then there's a way of positioning oneself to that heritage and that tradition that is a kind of rejection on the part of these groups. Now they're also dialoguing with it, and this is where it's a tense tension. They still use Brazilian rhythms, and they still use all kinds of different traditions that are very much from Brazil. And there's a sort of reclaiming in that. So the other term that I use a lot is cannibalism, and this is also something that people in the movement would talk about, which is a term that is a really prominent one in Brazilian musical traditions and popular music and the arts and the avant-garde, and refers to this idea that what is unique and really creative in Brazil as a sort of mode of cultural production is its openness not only to itself but to the world, and a sort of taking and eating of the world and regurgitating, or not regurgitating, but literally transforming that in the process of digestion into something that is authentically Brazilian. It's a gruesome metaphor, but one that people use a lot, as you know. And so people would use this to talk about neo-fanfarismo. So these brass bands, they're coming from the tradition of the Brazilian carnival, but they start to dialogue with these groups that are coming from other places, and they eat or consume these influences and transform them and make it into something new.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
One of the things that I was very impressed here is how you managed, it was this ability that you had to explain the hot mess of Brazilian social, political, historical context of the 2010s. I commend you for that, because I have a hard time every time people ask me to explain it. But that's where you're placing, right, this story, this movement in, as you call here, a severe political crisis in Brazil. Again, if in case anybody who's listening to this isn't very familiar with what was going on in Brazil at the time, could you try to summarize it for us?
I can try. And one thing that I think helps me understand it is the fact that, you know, I felt like Brazil was on a bit of a parallel track in terms of being in a hot mess in the 2010s to the U.S. In so many ways that it just felt like this sort of moment of hope at the beginning of the 2010s was kind of opened up. And this is from a left perspective. And with these protests that were very critical and seemed impactful, and sort of a closure of that, and then a sort of opening of a very dark period. So I'll try. More broadly, I would say that the book is kind of a story of transformation of these groups told alongside this political history. And so we've been talking about kind of the aesthetics, but the politics and the newness of neo-fascismo and being ismo as a kind of social movement is really critical to how I understand it as well. So we talked about the military dictatorship ending in 1985. There's a redemocratization. There's a new constitution. There's 1980s and 1990s are sort of difficult economic periods in this redemocratization process. But by 2002, you get something that's never happened before, which is that a leftist and avowed socialist wins the presidency. It's Lula da Silva and the Workers' Party. And he is... comes from a very, you know, leftist credentials of unions background, but he ends up governing in many ways as a centrist, in many ways by necessity to maintain political coalitions, and he generates this kind of amazing consensus. And this consensus is not only his popularity, but it's also the fact that Brazil was improving economically, basically. And this was based on a commodities boom that was not permanent. But by the time that Lula leaves, the number I have in my head is that he had 87% approval. Obama called him the most popular politician in the world. So if we think of the 2010s as a period of kind of a generation of consensus, then 2010s is a period of growing dissensus and polarization. One of the things that came out of this consensus was the awarding of both the World Cup and the Olympics to Brazil in the same decade, 2 years apart, 2014 for the World Cup and 2016 for the Olympics in Rio. And this just turned out to be when I was doing my fieldwork. I lived there between 2014 and 2016. And I didn't actually see either of those. I got there right after the World Cup and left right before. But these events were very, had a huge impact. Right before I got there, and the first time I went to Brazil, I mentioned these 2013 protests. These were very much articulated in relationship to these mega events. The economic progress that had grown under Lula had begun to reverse. Lula was no longer president, rather his successor, the same party, Dilma Rousseff, first woman president of Brazil, was in charge. But there was beginning to be some dissatisfaction, and this kind of exploded in 2013. Many people also saw it as an outgrowth of the Occupy movement or as a reverberation, other movements that were against austerity. It's indignados in Spain. Is very much like a sort of moment of global critique of austerity. And the way that this was expressed in relationship to mega events are, we're paying all this money for this mega events, and these stadiums are removing people from favelas. They're a huge expense, yet where's the investment? Where's the focus on public services and structure in an avowedly socialist or at least left, center-left party? And so this was the kind of the message that exploded in 2013. So this moment also becomes a moment that appears very hopeful, but ends up also generating a kind of backlash. And this backlash starts to grow. And this only gets worse with the Operation Car Wash scandal that starts to raise questions about the Workers' Party, as well as many other people in the government. And so Brazilian politics kind of takes this turn. And in 2016, Dilma Rousseff is actually impeached in what many people feel to be a coup, a legislative coup.
Let me just for the record, I believe foi golpe. Okay.
Yeah, okay. I also believe it was a golpe, right? But some people would not call it a golpe. But it didn't fit the traditional image, right, of a golpe. And of a golpe or a coup in Latin America or Brazil, which is a military dictatorship taking over. It was a use of parliamentary tactics to take out the president. And the vice president, coming from a coalition, was from the right, then turned out to take over. Which is not a system one would have in the U.S., right? Because where they're from the same party. No, the vice president was from a different party. And so it was very convenient to use this mechanism, this in the coup, to take over. Then a period of austerity begins. In the United States, Trump is elected and Brexit happens in the U.K. So not just sort of this right-wing austerity, neoliberal austerity, but this this much scarier authoritarian populist version of politics comes to Brazil. And Bolsonaro, who has been in politics for a long time, but then becomes rides this wave, ends up winning the presidency in 2018, very much thought of as a kind of Trump, quote unquote, Trump of the tropics, and governs in very, very similar ways to Trump. And when he was defeated, there was even also rushing or an invasion of Brazilian capital buildings, right? Similar to what happened in January 6th in 2021. So when I said that, I just felt like there was these parallel tracks that the US and Brazil were on. That's what I meant. And also, Bolsonaro was defeated, right? Lula has now come back. So we're in a new moment. And I'm glad that I was able to finish and publish this book before that happens, because we don't know how things are going to go right now. But the sort of whole frame of the book is thinking about neofanfarismo as a movement that becomes more and more political in this process of polarization over the course of the past decade or so.
So as you were saying, right, how did the neofanfarista movement become socially and politically engaged in this context that you just described? And how is this then connected to an increased diversity of the participants of the movement?
Yeah, so I got there in 2014, and 2013 was very much fresh in people's minds. And these were major, major protests, right? The biggest mobilization in years. And the way that people described it is, whereas Carnival had sort of critical aspects and, you know, playing in the streets could be thought of as activists in the way it, you know, democratizes public space, and whereas there's a critique of the mode of production that the Samba schools represent, we could think of all of that as also kind of apolitical and ludic and fun. Even if, you know, all of culture is political, this wasn't culture necessarily that was oppositional or that it manifested itself in that way. But 2013, people talked about as a marking point where a lot of groups went to play in the protests, as I had said. They played in support of various causes. So there's these kinds of lines in the sand that start to be drawn. And this process, I believe, only becomes stronger and stronger as these crises grow, right? So then you have an impeachment process of the coup. And so the bands start to play in favor of democracy, even if not everyone loves Dilma, but there's a desire at least to stave off the right, and then the right succeeds. And so then there's protests against the various, there was an attempt to shut down the Ministry of Culture, right? And the groups played for these protests and occupied the Ministry of Culture. So these bands become increasingly politically involved in very objective ways. They go to protests, they post on social media, they make signs, they politicize Carnival also. They start to bring these kinds of repertoires and oppositional attitudes and expressive tactics to a space that could be thought of as kind of apolitical or at least not demonstrably oppositional. Yeah, over this period, the groups become more political in that sense. But they also, I think, become political in the sense of questioning their own identities as a movement. And I mean, sort of class, racial, gender identities. We talked about alternative whiteness, alternative middle class. Also, a lot of these groups were initially very, very male. But in the mid-2000s, and that was the time that I was there, there were a couple things that happened. One was the founding of a group called Damas de Ferro, or the Iron Ladies. This is the first all-women group in this movement. Now there are, I believe, about five. There's been an explosion of female participation in the movement. Another thing that happened, I believe, also in 2014, was the founding of a group called Favela Brás, which was actually founded by an Englishman who lives in Rio and an English trumpet player, Tom Ash, who went and lived in a favela in the center of Rio and started teaching children to play, and has now generated this group that plays in that plays regularly. So these are two examples that I used to talk about, a desire to reach beyond gender lines and reach beyond class and racial lines. And that I think those conversations were very present when I was there. People were, Carnival is, think about it as inclusive and participatory and democratic. And so these groups are, well, how does that actually manifest itself? How can we make it more democratic or inclusive? One of the most interesting products that I have seen come up, and this started after my field work ended in 2016, but the main group I should have mentioned by now that I worked with is called Orquesta Voadora, and they are a massive group, and a massive group as a bloco. They're about 400 musicians, but this is a group that is run by a band that is about 15 musicians. So you have 15 professional musicians who play shows, and they have a weekly class, or what is called an oficina, and all many groups have a class where they teach musicians, in many cases, new musicians, people who've never played an instrument, to play with them. So there's this expansion of musical interest. And this is another way that music starts to, interest in participation. It's another way that music starts to reach beyond these various social divisions. And sort of the women's groups start to play coming out of that. But one of the most interesting projects of Orquesta Voadora in the past few years has been an attempt to change practices, structure, and the whole setup of the bloco to be inclusive of people with disabilities. And of course, people with disabilities, it's a category that is itself very diverse. So they've really been trying to think about this from the perspective of people who are already in the group and their needs, their access needs to be a part of this, but also to publicize the idea of Carnival needing to be accessible to people with disabilities, and to, from a very anti-ableist perspective. And they speak in this language. I mean, this is, we talked about it being middle class, it's a highly educated movement in a major global city. So the having access to sort of language of anti-ableism, right, is part of this movement. But what I think is amazing is really using those ideas to change Carnival practices. So this is something that started during the pandemic and has continued in various ways during the pandemic and is continuing now. And their last Carnival theme was actually "The future is anti-ableist." So you see, there's various ways of thinking about their politics in a sort of very objective, oppositional way, but also all of these ways of trying to democratize, diversify, and be more inclusive as a musical movement.
But you also show that there were some challenges and even some shortcomings to that process. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, and middle-class movement, I think it's a great example of a middle-class movement is not going to change the world by itself, right? And the reason I really try to call attention to the class and racial situatedness of these groups of people is that they're reaching across these boundaries, but that doesn't itself deconstruct, of course, doesn't construct racism or sexism or homophobia or ableism. So these are inherently limited actions. Many of the structures of inequality that we see in this society at large continue to manifest themselves in the neo-fanfarismo movement. That being said, I think that there has grown, especially during this period of polarization, a desire, an authentic, genuine desire, not on the part of everyone, but on the part of key people who have managed to make new critical projects happen, to really do something new and think about Carnival as a kind of activist. Carnival is a potential space for activist projects that are critical of society.
Well, since you used, you're already talking about Carnival conceptually, I cannot, you're just almost like legally obligated to, if you're talking about Carnival theory, to ask you about that old debate that has animated the field of Carnival studies. I know we've sort of moved past that, but you're making an interesting contribution to it. So I'm talking here more specifically this debate over whether Carnival subverts or reinforces the status quo. I think we've sort of agreed as a collective of Carnival scholars that it can be both. But you note here that this debate fails to engage with an important question. Quote, how do the ideals of Carnival inspire political and social engagement? So tell us how is that and how your book is dealing with that, how you position yourself and the book within those debates.
Yeah, you're right. I think a book like this that's talking about Carnival as potentially political cannot fail to at least note the fact that this is a big part of how we have historically tried to understand Carnival. Is it something that is resistant in the sense of really its spirit? I think there's a lot of elements of the discourse around Carnival as being resistant, turning the world upside down, inverting structures. And the response to that, right, is like, well, but all of that is, it's kind of like a weekend. It allows the work week to function. You need to give people time off in order for them to at least the minimum amount of time off to blow steam, to be productive. And that is a part of a governing process, right? So that's the response, right? Is it resistant or is it actually just end up restructuring society along the same lines, reinforcing the status quo? And as you said, I think that we now think that they're, you know, it can be both. As our colleague Ohili Godet says, it's indeterminate. It's Carnival is not inherently anything, right? It can manifest itself in various different ways. But the idea that you referred to, Carnival ideals inspire political social engagement. So this really came to me from one quote really begin the book with, where one of my interlocutors talked about, Bakhtin, who's this famous Carnival theorist and really the main person people talk about when they think about Carnival as subversive. Bakhtin thinks that Carnival is subversive, and so Carnival should be subversive. That is what Carnival is, right? So the idea is not to take it ethically or an outside perspective of Carnival and say, this is what Carnival is. We can see that activism is happening in this space, so it's Bakhtinian. But no, like, they're actually referring to Bakhtin. They're thinking about Carnival in this way. So in that sense, it's performative. It's discourse that enacts a kind of reality. And so that was really impressive to me in the sense of really the theory behind the actions and the way that the actions also kind of end up justifying and reinforcing this kind of theory about Carnival being subversive. The other thing that was impressive is the fact that this person is citing Bakhtin, right? Bakhtin is not something that is not a person that every Carnival musician is necessarily going to know. It's humanities and social science famous reference, but you really need to be kind of within those debates to know who this person is. But this person did, and that really reinforced also kind of this is a middle class movement. This is a group of people. Many of whom are highly educated, have access to education. And there's inequalities and disparate experiences within that, but there is this important kind of class element to consider. So using that citation, I kind of also opened that a point of thinking about the situatedness of the movement. But that was the attempt, I guess, at trying to intervene in this long debate of is Carnival subversive or is it not? Well, maybe it's subversive if people think it is and they enact it to be as such.
So your final chapter is talking about the honk movement. And you characterize the founding of the Honk Rio Festival as this consolidation of the musical social movement. Tell us how and why is that? But I think first you would have to give us a brief introduction to the global honk movement. You sort of mentioned, right, that's how was your entry way into this subject and this research. But tell us a bit about that.
Exactly. This is where we come full circle, because in 2012, I go to this festival in Boston, and I'm introduced to this idea of a network of brass bands that play musically eclectic genres and maybe think about themselves as in some way activists. And then I hear about this group in Rio, and then I go to Rio, and in 2014, they're talking about starting their own honk, and in 2015, they do. So Honk as a movement starts in Boston in 2006. It's really a consolidation point for a lot of groups in the United States that have been playing music on the streets against the Iraq War protests. This sort of idea of a kind of DIY brass band festival starts to become more and more interesting as some of these groups play, and they want to do their own festival. So this idea of a honk festival starts to go to various places in the United States. And in 2015, it starts to go international in both Brazil and Australia, incidentally. Since then, we find some manifestation of honk on literally every continent, including Australia, because they participated in an online event during the pandemic. But otherwise, every continent now has some connection to this idea of a festival of activist brass bands. So as we talked about, these brass bands coming out of Carnival had already been thinking about themselves as practicing a kind of critical activist musical new take on this tradition of the brass band that is inherently militant, right? The brass band is potentially inherently political, but this is a subversion of that. And a group had gone to Honk in Boston. And so I come and I show up in Rio and they're talking about Honk there. It was this kind of amazing expression of globalization in a good sense, where this very marginal, unknown festival is being talked about in a completely different city in a completely different country. So this idea of a honk festival in Rio, I thought was maybe just kind of hot water. Like, is this really going to happen? This is a massive undertaking. But after the 2015 Carnival ended in February, people started talking about it. And they started theorizing, thinking about what would it mean to do this kind of originally American festival in Brazil. What kind of language do we need to create? And they actually use publicly this idea of cannibalization, like the cannibalizing the festival. They're eating this outside influence and taking it in and transforming it and mixing it with what is authentically Brazilian and Carnival. And so they generate this this whole discourse and public image about brass bands being activists. They call it the Honk Rio Festival de Fanfares Activistas, or the Honk Rio Festival of Activist Brass Bands. So that in that sense, it consolidates the movement around activism in a very public way. It consolidates the idea of a brass band as being very international. Groups from the United States come, a group from Chile came, and a group from France came. So in that very first instantiation, it was very international. My group, this was another moment of coming full circle, but a group that I had co-founded called Mission Delirium, I managed to help them, we collectively organized a tour to participate in this first festival, first edition of Honk. And so it was this international meeting. So in that sense, I talk about it as a moment of consolidation, and I use it to end the book, which is, for me, the whole book is a story of transformation of a movement that begins in street carnival that is not necessarily political, to one that is very musically eclectic and internationally minded and very politically minded. And so Honk really represents that change. And now 2015, now that's 8 years ago, for God's sake. Honk has spread as a movement in Brazil. There are festivals in Sao Paulo, in Porto Alegre, in Brasilia. I believe there are at least five now in Brazil. So this whole neo-fanfarismo movement, also since I was in Brazil, has spread to other cities in Brazil. So from a sort of outside perspective, have seen the movement grow. But then Honk as an idea, which is an American idea, has really become crucial to this movement and to really transforming in turn Carnival in Brazil. It's kind of this amazing, for me, obviously, amazing story of globalization in a good sense.
But before we go, can you share with us your new projects? What are you working on next? Of course, other than joining us at the Journal of Festive Studies, I wanted to just give a very quick shameless plug. I joined the Journal of Festive Studies as a co-editor for the forthcoming issue, number 5, and you are joining us for number 6. So now that I got the shameless plug out of the way, tell us what you've been working on since this book.
Thanks. I'm super excited to be joining Journal of Festive Studies. I was actually able to publish an article about these groups' response to the pandemic in that journal, where they mobilized people to do the opposite of what they usually do, subvert the meaning of carnival, and tell people to actually stay home and not go to the streets. And so I wrote about that for the Journal of Festive Studies, and I'm really excited to be also working as an editor in the near future. So as you mentioned, I'm in Portugal. I'm doing a postdoc in Portugal, which I haven't talked about since. But yeah, this connection to Brazilian studies is the reason that I wound up doing this postdoc in Portugal. And I'll be here for at least a few more years. The project that I ended up pursuing was to talk about street carnival, the Brazilian street carnival that's emerging in Lisbon. So a lot of the same kinds of groups, not exactly neo-fanfarrismo, but a bit more diverse collection of groups that have come in really in the past 8 years or so, as a lot of, well, the Brazilian alternative middle class has been migrating and leaving in during this period of political crisis. And there's also Brazilian immigration that goes beyond that and is before it, but it's a big motivator for people that I've talked to. It's talked about sort of this manifestation of Brazilian street carnival in the historical ex-colony or the ex-colonizer, right? And sort of all the post-colonial manifestation of negotiation and relationship that occurs in these carnival spaces in a completely different context, in a different city, but one that is very unique. It's not carnival in whatever country, and in Europe or the United States. It's in a space that is much more culturally resonant, and at least in sort of unpacking this colonial relationship between Brazil and Portugal. So that's the main project that I'm working on these days, and as well as working with you all in the future.
Oh, so just before we go, just wanted to use this opportunity, since we're both editors of this journal, to invite people to submit their work. So if anybody who's listening to us, if you are working with thinking about celebrations, festivity, we're very happy to consider your submissions. We accept not only academic articles, but also types of creative interventions, other things. So please contact us. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. I just spoke with Andrew Snyder about Critical Brass, Street Carnival, and Musical Activism in Olympic Rio de Janeiro. It was published by Wesleyan University Press in 2022. I'm Isabel Machado. Until next time.